Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Africa's Constitutional Court has ordered President Jacob Zuma to repay some of the $16 million in public funds used for upgrades at his private home. The ruling Thursday comes as authorities investigate Zuma for another more recent scandal, alleged undue influence given to the wealthy Gupta family.
That's Tuso Kumalo reporting from Johannesburg. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, at least six people have been killed and an unknown number of others wounded when a suicide bomber targeted a treasury official in the Somali town of Galkayo. While well over 1.5 million people in parts of Puntland and Somaliland need humanitarian assistance because of prolonged drought, and the UN investigates more allegations of sex abuse by peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Africa's Constitutional Court has ordered President Jacob Zuma to repay some of the $16 million in public funds used for upgrades at his private home. The ruling comes as authorities investigate Mr. Zuma for another more recent scandal. It involves alleged undue influence given to the wealthy Gupta family in South Africa. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Handing down the Constitutional Court judgment on Thursday, Chief Justice Mogoeng Mogoeng said President Zuma violated the Constitution when he ignored the public protector's order to pay back some of the money used to build nanny security features at his private home.
The failure by the President to comply with the remedial action taken against him by the public protector in her report of 19 March 2014 is inconsistent with Section 83B of the Constitution and is invalid.
The court gave the National Treasury 60 days to determine how much Zuma should pay. Mogoeng said once the court receives the Treasury's report, Zuma must pay.
The President must personally pay the amount determined by the National Treasury within 45 days of this court's signification of its approval of the report.
The court also had harsh words for the National Assembly, where the ruling African National Congress allegedly shielded Zuma from paying back the money.
The resolution passed by the National Assembly, absolving the President from compliance with the remedial action taken by the public protector, is invalid and is set aside.
The Democratic Alliance Party and the Economic Freedom Fighters Party have pledged to impeach Zuma and remove him from office for violating the Constitution. Both the ANC and President Zuma have issued statements welcoming the judgment, saying they respect it. Political analyst Levindo says Zuma's fate is in the hands of the majority ANC party in parliament.
If they come out clearly and say the state president has breached his oath of office, that would provide sufficient reasons for parliament to move for a motion of no confidence on the state president.
The judgment has created more problems for the already embattled president. The country's elite police unit is also investigating Zuma's son for allegedly helping the wealthy Gupta family influence the appointment of ministers. The probe follows claims by government officials that people involved with the Gupta family's extensive business holdings offered them ministerial posts. The ruling ANC is also investigating, which analysts say could further hurt President Zuma's standing. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Tuso. For an analysis of today's ruling by South Africa's Constitutional Court, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke to Professor Stephen Friedman. He's director of the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Johannesburg and Rhodes University. Professor Friedman first addressed the constitutional issues involved in the court's ruling against President Zuma.
There are two constitutional issues at the heart of this case, which are related to each other. The one which is not getting much publicity because everybody's focused on the future of the president is the role of the public protector. The incumbent is supposed to protect the interests of the public and to ensure that government acts in a way that is accountable to the public. And for much of the time that this office has been there since 1994, it's been assumed that the public protector can only recommend, that the public protector cannot enforce government to do what she finds. What the court has now decided is that her findings, well, the person in charge now is a woman, maybe it'll be a man in the future, but the public protector's findings are now binding. That means that government has to obey them unless it challenges them in court. And Parliament has to obey them unless it challenges it in court. The other issue is, of course, relates to did the President and Parliament defy the Constitution or refuse to uphold the Constitution by not implementing the recommendations of the public protector? And, of course, the court found that that was the case. The court didn't say that they did it deliberately. It was outside his mandate to do that.
Professor, this seems to be an issue of checks and balances that might be new to the South African government. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, what we're seeing here is a fascinating process. You know, people who are used to these checks and balances, there are, of course, some countries where they've been enforced for many years, tend to forget that even in those countries where they've been there for many years, they were very difficult to establish in the first place and were challenged later on. The reason for that, of course, is that there's nothing natural or automatic about the idea that people in positions of political power should have to limit their power by listening to the courts, by allowing the media to be free, by accepting all sorts of limits on their power which come with democratic government. People who hold political power challenge these rules, or they try to push the rules and try to find how much they can get away with. And then what happens to your society really depends on whether that is successful or not. And what is happening in South Africa at the moment, very interestingly, despite a lot of pessimism from many people, is that those who are trying to push against the rules are not winning.
Professor, here in the United States, our highest court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has been accused at times of being political. Do you see those accusations at all being leveled against South Africa's constitutional court?
Well, the odd thing, in a sense, is that they haven't been leveled against the court. And the reason I say it's an odd thing is that I think all constitutional courts are political. I mean, whether you're talking about your court in America or you're talking about the German court, what many constitutional democracies do is to put in place procedures which recognize that it's political, so that you need confirmation by Congress in your case, or the Germans have a system where you balance it. If you appoint a judge from the governing party, you have to appoint a judge from the opposition party. And therefore, you know, it's acknowledged in most countries that constitutional courts are political. And what you try to do is to make sure that your system balances this by making sure that everybody's represented.
What does this ruling mean for future South African presidents and the parliament?
They've been told quite clearly that this office of the public protector, which has become a very popular office in this country, that this office is now protected by the Constitution.
That's Professor Stephen Friedman, director of the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Johannesburg and Rhodes University. From Johannesburg, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. At least six people have been killed and an unknown number of others were wounded when a suicide bomber targeted a treasury official in the Somali town of Galkayo. Witnesses told the VOA Somali service that the bomber hugged the official, Saeed Ali Yusuf, before blowing himself up. The Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Security officials in Galkayo in the Puntland region say they have detained several people in connection with the blast. Aid agencies say well over 1.5 million people in parts of Puntland and Somaliland need humanitarian assistance because of prolonged drought. That's nearly 40% of the population in those areas. The agency say most of those in need are on the verge of acute food insecurity. Humanitarian groups are appealing for $105 million to increase assistance. Some of the funds would be used for emergency health services, water, and sanitation. The drought also has resulted in the loss of livestock, threatening the livelihoods of many families. The UN is investigating more allegations of sex abuse by peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. The disturbing new allegations come from the group AIDS Free World as part of its Code Blue campaign. It says nearly 100 girls have reported they were sexually assaulted. Some allege that a French commander undressed them, tied them up, and forced them to perform unnatural sex acts. They also say a fourth girl who was tied up died of unknown causes. The UN had already been investigating other allegations of child rape and sex abuse allegations by peacekeepers in CAR and elsewhere, and by some members of the French force in CAR. A UN spokesman says the latest accusations from AIDS Free World date back to 2013, but say the allegations are also against local armed groups. In related news, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zaid Rahad Al Hussein, describes the latest allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation as sickening. He says that major efforts were already underway to investigate allegations uncovered by a series of UN teams sent to the region over the past 2 weeks. This month, a UN report said there were nearly 70 allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation by peacekeepers in 2015, with more than 20 of them in CAR. The Burundi government says it will investigate yesterday's death of a former Rwandan ambassador in the central prison in Bujumbura. A family member says Jacques Bihozagara may have died of food poisoning. The former Rwandan government official was arrested more than a year ago and charged with spying. VOA's David Arnold spoke with reporter Moses Habyarimana in Bujumbura about the story.
Well, currently the Burundian government have yet commented on what was the cause of the death of the former diplomat and the minister of Rwanda, Jacques Bihozagara, who had died yesterday in the afternoon in Bujumbura Central Prison. However, the spokesman of the Burundi Ministry of Justice said that they are still carrying out investigation on the cause of his death, and the autopsy is soon going to be made and in order to reveal exactly what killed the former minister of Rwanda.
And who is it that made the claim that he died of food poisoning?
It's not yet confirmed sources, though. However, there are some statements which have been made in the media, and they say that possibly it could be one of the close members of the families who say that he may have died of food poisoning. However, we understand one of the sources in Bujumbura Central Prison said that he was in good health in the morning. Hours later, they saw him falling down in the central prison and rushed to the nearby health center within the prison. So that's where he passed on. But the Burundi government haven't really made out an official comment on exactly what was the cause of his death.
Why was he in prison in the first place?
Jacques Bihozagara is a former Rwandan minister, a long-time diplomat and ambassador of France to Rwanda and Belgium. He was arrested last year in December, and they have been accused of spying on Burundi. According to a Burundian official whom I talked to in the condition of anonymous, he said that the official was arrested alongside the FNL militant. We know that he has been having some business in Bujumbura capital for decades.
What kind of business was he in Bujumbura?
His nearby relatives say that he has many housing facilities in Burundi, and he has spent more years in Burundi investing in housing even before the crisis. We haven't yet got an official statement. Probably today in the afternoon or late, we may get an official statement on it.
That was reporter Moses Habyarimana in Bujumbura talking with VOA's David Arnold. It's been about 2 weeks since the European Union and Turkey signed a deal to stem the flow of migrants and refugees to Europe. Under the plan, for every migrant sent back to Turkey for registration, another would be resettled by the EU. The French news agency says the first group of migrants is scheduled to return to Turkey from Greece on Monday. A source tells AFP about 500 people, including Syrians, Afghans, and Pakistanis, will be sent back to Turkey from one of the Greek islands. It's not clear whether they will make the journey by sea or air. Meanwhile, Reuters reports Greece is busing hundreds of migrants and refugees from a port near Athens to accommodations elsewhere in the country. They had spent weeks living out in the open. In all, more than 50,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece after the Balkan countries closed their borders to them. Representatives of nearly 50 nations will attend a nuclear security summit here in Washington tonight and tomorrow. President Obama will host the summit that aims, in part, to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of such groups as the Islamic State. This week, a number of experts met to discuss the importance of the Washington meeting at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS. Susan Squassoni is the director of the group's Proliferation Prevention Program. She says one goal of the summit should be to monitor or reduce the amount of nuclear material in military stockpiles.
There have been successes in this process since 2010, but the overall objective of securing all the most vulnerable nuclear materials in 4 years, I think we can safely say a lot of progress has happened, but that goal I don't think has been achieved. There is still material out there, and the material that we're talking about is highly enriched uranium, 25 kilograms of which can be used to make a nice nuclear explosive, and separated plutonium.
She says participants could agree to a common policy to curb nuclear proliferation. That could include inspecting each other's nuclear facilities or increasing the exchange of information between countries with nuclear material. She says governments should also discuss legally binding obligations to implement security measures like those at U.S. nuclear facilities.
That is a big, you know, when we think about a nuclear terrorist threat, there are a couple different categories, right? One is building an improvised nuclear device by stealing material. Another is sabotaging nuclear facilities, and that's what we're worried about, for example, in Belgium. And the last is a dirty bomb. So that's where you take some radioactive material. It's not HEU or plutonium. It's just simply maybe a medical radioisotope that you use for cancer therapy. You wrap it in explosives and then set it off as a terror device. There's a lot more to be done on strengthening the security of those sources.
Dozens of heads of state are expected to attend the summit. One leader who does not plan to attend is Russian President Vladimir Putin. Moscow instead will be sending observers. Olga Oliker is the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at CSIS.
That doesn't mean that Russia opposes the goals of the summit, that it's opposed to nuclear security. It doesn't emphasize them the way the United States does, but generally speaking, it has cooperated on nuclear security issues, including things like getting highly enriched uranium out of countries like Kazakhstan and Poland. It's cooperated on the Iran deal, obviously on North Korea issues. And of course, Russia and the United States co-chair the global initiative to combat nuclear terrorism. And I'd argue Russia likes this better.
CSIS experts say past summits have made progress in improving security. For example, in recent years, over a dozen countries have removed nuclear material, while others have adopted measures to better secure and protect their facilities. Experts say they hope this summit will be even more productive. This Saturday, Kenya will mark the 1-year anniversary of the terror attack on Garissa University. Al-Shabaab militants killed 148 people on the campus. Most of the dead were students. In the past year, Kenya says it has heightened its response capabilities. The region and the continent remain on high alert for further attacks. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
On April 2, 2015, four gunmen from the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab stormed Garissa University in northeastern Kenya. 22-year-old Steve Mwangi was there. He hid in a cupboard with three others.
We headed from around 7 in the morning to 6:30 in the afternoon when the Rex squad came into the hotel. I didn't even think I would get out of that room because when I realized they are serious and killing people and they killed two of my roommates, I was like, next, they will come confirm with me inside the hotel. But fortunately, they did.
Mwangi moved off campus and now he commutes. He says he won't sleep in the dorm in case of another attack. Al-Shabaab militants said they attacked the university as payback for Kenyan military operations in Somalia. The siege at Garissa went on for at least 12 hours. Militants killed 148 people and wounded dozens others. Kenyan security forces were severely criticized for their slow response. According to local media, it took them at least 7 hours to reach the university. Interior Ministry spokesman Mwenda Njoka told VOA those deficiencies have been addressed.
With the refurbishment of helicopters and the additional that are also being bought, it means our paramilitary are able to move within the fastest time. Like, for instance, the reaction time for Garissa University, everybody admits that we didn't move as fast as we should have. But if we had the kind of equipment we have now, we'd have been able to get troops there within an hour or less.
And security analysts say the risk of similar attacks remain high. Homeland security expert Richard Tuta points out that the attack on Garissa, like the most recent spate of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, attacks on hotels in West Africa, required just a handful of fighters.
The return will be very high in terms of the number of casualties, and the cost of attacking those targets is very minimum because they don't require a lot of preparation. They don't require a lot of expertise in order to penetrate some of these soft target.
A single attack like Garissa or the deadly three-day siege of Westgate Mall in Nairobi in 2013 were propaganda boons for Al-Shabaab. When Garissa happened in 2015, it had seemed Al-Shabaab was on the defensive amid continued pressure from African Union troops in Somalia. But shortly after, in mid-2015, the balance began to shift. Militants have raided military bases in Somalia, walking away with gear and killing dozens of regional troops in at least two attacks. Al-Shabaab has also increased bomb attacks in Somalia. Some experts believe the Al-Qaeda affiliate is in a fierce battle for survival as Islamic State group lures away its fighters and draws new recruits in the region. Observers also note that African terror affiliates are jockeying for funding and influence. Nairobi-based security expert Andrew Franklin sees more local motivations.
We are also missing out on the big picture, which is that Al-Shabaab's objective, its focus, if you will, for 2016, is on derailing the election scheduled in Mogadishu in August of 2016. Its objective is to demonstrate that the federal government of Somalia is unable to hold elections.
Since Garissa, Kenya has not seen a major terror attack, but the threat remains, and security experts say African security agencies must work together to stop militant groups and combat the spread of extremist ideology that is radicalizing young people. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And for stay tuned for the sunny side of sports coming up at 1800 UTC. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
Can't get enough of the Sunny Side of Sports? Well, we've solved that problem. We now have a half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. So visit voanews.com for more details and enjoy the show. Enjoy the show.